ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The world right now is a disaster. It's easy to feel helpless. But there was a moment when millions of people around the world said enough. I'm Sisong Kim Simong. Join me for Boycott, the fight to end apartheid, how Australians joined others around the world to push back against racism and won.
Whites-only teams, we thought that to the average Australian, that would be despicable.
Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, there you go. Hello. Welcome to the Minefield Live. It's my favourite kind of minefield where we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. You just heard an audience there that's already far too receptive to what we're about to do. We are joining you, we're coming to you today from Customs House, a wonderful building on the banks of the Brisbane River for a live recording, which is a partnership between us, the Minefield, ABC Radio National, the University of Queensland, Dialogues Across Difference event series, and also the Brisbane Writers Festival. I think this is a first for us. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens, hello.
Hey, it's good to be with you.
Your hometown, you're playing at home today.
This is the first live event we've ever done in Brisbane.
Yeah.
You know.
So if it doesn't go well, we'll know what the problem was, is the way I hear about it. What do you want to do today?
So let me just be pretty upfront with what it is that we're going to be doing in this conversation. We really do want to talk about the nature of political authority, but we want to look at what political authority is, what its nature is, through the lens of one of the ways that it can go terribly wrong. And it seems to me that one of the many ways that political authority can go very, very wrong is by having the exercise of that authority, the exercise of political power, turn in on itself. Augustine had this wonderful way of describing a life that has gone off the rails, a life that is turned in, if you like, into the service of ego. He used the phrase in curvatus in se, a life that no longer serves its proper ends, its proper goals, but instead has found a certain degree of self-satisfaction, self-gratification, self-ingratiation, self-enrichment. So this is a form of politics that we're all pretty much aware of, isn't it? It's a form of politics we would ordinarily maybe describe as corrupt politics, where people get into political office because they want to self-enrich, or they want to enrich those around them, and they form cadres of like-minded whatever. That's a form of politics that we recognize and that most voters rightly condemn. But that's not quite the form of politics that we're going to be discussing today. The form of politics that we want to discuss is probably best described as autocratic politics or autocracy. And it's not just that autocracies are standardly corrupt in that way. I mean, they are corrupt. But one of the forms of corruption isn't just the form of self-enrichment that often goes along with corrupt politics. It's the fact that this particular form of politics has cast off those necessary constraints that make politics within a representative democracy open to moral and political scrutiny. So this is a different form of corruption. I think this is a more thoroughgoing form of corruption, because it's not just a corruption of a particular office, it's the corruption of politics itself. So let me just, can I just try to lay out these two things and then?
Sure.
So the two constraints. That was artificial permission. I was just going to keep going.
I had a question, but you cut me off.
All right, but go on.
No, I've forgotten the question now. You're going to have to...
That's the point. You keep talking, and then whoever's going to ask you. So what are the two constraints that make politics within a representative democracy a form of moral activity? It seems to me that the first form is that it is necessarily restrained. Politics, in order to be politics, has got to be restrained by something. In other words, it has to meet a certain form of resistance. And this isn't just the resistance of an external opposition party. This is the necessary form of resistance that goes along with checks and balances, that goes along with the deliberative process through which legislation is crafted, is held up for scrutiny, is compromised on and passed. In other words, frictionless politics is, by its very definition, corrupt politics. Friction, resistance within a political order is the way that things are supposed to work.
Are you happy for that restraint or constraint to be informal? So if it's not institutionalized, if it exists in the form of, I don't know, a code of honor or some other kind of moral limit, would that be sufficient for you to escape this condemnatory label?
Of corruption? I mean, frankly, yes, because some of these forms of constraint aren't necessarily public constraint. These are forms of restraint that can, in fact, take place in closed-door deliberations. These
may not even be deliberative, though.
Do you mean someone stepping into a political office that has a particular weight to it, that has a particular code of honor that attaches to it, that has internal constraints?
And they might have a particular vocational sense of what they are doing. They don't face institutional restraints in the way that we typically understand them, but they do face perhaps ideological constraint, or they face some other kind of intangible constraint. I just wonder whether you would consider that sufficient.
Not sufficient, but part of the whole. Mm. And in fact, any form of political restraint that is simply codified, that's simply part of established procedure or inscribed into law, was probably insufficient. I mean, this is something that John Rawls recognized. Democracy cannot be democracy if at a certain point the trappings of democracy fall away, unless there is a kind of an ethos, a democratic ethos that underlies the entire thing. He called these the sentiments of justice.
Which brings us to a discussion of the US.
Yeah, well, hang on. The other form, the other restraint.
Yes, is this the second limb? I was waiting for this. Yes.
The other form of restraint that autocratic politics or corrupt politics casts off is the idea of politics as revocable. In other words, it's not your possession. This office that you inhabit, it's not your possession. It's something that's been entrusted to you. It's something that will then be handed on to someone else, and someone else with whom you might violently politically disagree. And so this idea of restraint and revocability, that politics is about a vocation that's been entrusted to you and something that is bound up with a certain degree of resistance. When those two things are shed, when they are cut away from the understanding of how politics works, of what it's supposed to be, then it seems to me you have a recipe for a thoroughgoingly corrupt politics, where politics is no longer able to serve the end that can in any way be defined as moral.
Okay, so you said at the start we're talking about autocratic politics. Are you saying autocratic politics and corrupt politics are the same thing? Are they coextensive? Or are you saying that one is a precondition for the other? And are we interested only in full-blown autocracies, or are we interested in the autocratic instinct in politics? I'm just interested in how you want to frame this, because as you've been speaking, I've imagined, I don't know, let's call it five different conversations we could be having here.
Mm. Autocracy is a species of corrupt politics.
Right. But not all corrupt politics is autocracy.
You would have to say, though, that virtually any form of corrupt politics is going to have some kind of family resemblance to that desire to hold on to political power, to not give it up, to not pass it on to the next person. And it would also, at some fundamental point, believe that any challenge that is brought to the exercise of political power diminishes the power itself. And so, again, you have this
So the idea is that politics is not enhanced by resistance.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly
right. The case study I keep thinking of, though, as you talk, and we don't want to go too far into this because I know we have a wonderful guest and we want to, but the case study I keep thinking of is, okay, what do you then make of something like the Chinese Communist Party? So the power is irrevocable in the sense that it's a one-party state. It is identified with the leader, but it is not confined to that leader, and it doesn't stop at that leader, that there is succession. There are party congresses. We can have a discussion about to what extent these are events of real deliberation and so on, but nonetheless, the mechanism is kind of there. It is a politics, though, that I think most people, if you took a random sample, if you did a family feud survey of 100 Australians, would probably describe it as autocratic. I don't know that I would call it the cult of the leader in the way that perhaps we've seen in other autocracies. I'd have to think about that, but it doesn't strike me that way, at the very least. How would you choose to categorize this?
Just very, very briefly, I think one of the striking things about an autocracy is that it hangs upon a unitary figure, a figure who has power, but almost power by right. That's why we often...
Even if that's temporary?
But this is part of the hitch, isn't it?
Yeah.
That yes, temporary, but also maybe not?
Yeah.
So if we think about democratic politics as being contingent and as to some extent kind of existing on the surface of things, as soon as there is a thoroughgoing explanation, I have this by right. It is mine by right. It is mine because of some deep substance that I represent. It is mine because of the symbolic hold that I have upon a people. It's mine because of the kind of adulatory effect. Everybody loves me, therefore it's mine. Ooh. Then I think there you're probably getting a little bit closer to the image of the Communist Party, where the leader does in fact refer to something deeper than just this figure. The character of a unitary figure is that they gather up in themselves a whole bundle of meaning, of symbols that give them depth. But I think one of the crucial things about democratic politics is because it is revocable and because it's constrained, that depth is only able to go so deep. The depth is in the performance of a certain moral duty. And this, it seems to me, is why autocracies need spectacle. When you haven't got any substantive claim on power, the power is mine because of who I am. The power is mine because of who I represent. The power cannot be challenged because it diminishes the power, and the power cannot be taken away from me because of the political equivalent of a dead man's switch. If my thumb comes off it, then everything goes. When that is the claim, then you need to make all of these performances for why a depth really is there. In other words, this is why autocracies tend to gravitate towards spectacle, towards aesthetic. These are all ways of convincing a public, convincing a people that there is a depth, that there is a substance, that there is a weight that may or may not.
So you know what else has tremendous spectacle? Royal families.
True.
The United States of America.
True.
And here I'm not talking about the current iteration of the United States of America. I'm talking about it as, I mean, anyone who's been to an inauguration. And one of the reasons an inauguration looks like it does is that the president is also head of state. It's effectively a coronation. Mm. It's what you get when you don't have a royal family, but you want sort of that sort of affectation.
Yeah, but it's also a celebration of succession.
Yeah, that's true. Which happens within royal families as well.
Yeah.
You don't want me to keep walking down this path, do you? Should we just...
Is this where you let people know that you're a closet monarchist?
No. Or? I'm just interested in the limits of the ideas, that's all. That's all I'm trying to figure out. All right, shall we get to our guest? You are listening to The Minefield on ABC Radio National. It's a live event, a partnership between us at Radio National, the Brisbane Writers Festival and the University of Queensland.
Our guest is M. Gessen, an award-winning and acclaimed Russian-American journalist, author, activist, known for their influential writings on authoritarianism, human rights, and LGBTQ issues, most notably for their columns in The New Yorker and The New York Times, and also most recent books, Surviving Autocracy and The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Claimed Russia. M., welcome to The Minefield.
Good to be here.
So I've tried to sketch out a kind of diagnosis. It's not really a diagnosis, but it's a reflection of my understanding, our understanding of autocracy and how autocracy does seem to exist in a kind of continuum with democratic politics. I think
it can.
It can. Why don't you just pick things up there?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that the autocracies that we are observing in the modern world right now are, I think they're best termed electoral autocracies, which means they maintain some trappings of electoral democracy. And in fact, you know, they have elections, they even have campaigns. You know, Putin gets reelected every 6 years in order for him to extend the length of the presidential term and also be able to, you know, to continue getting elected. He actually had to have the parliament perform the semblance of a constitutional amendment, right? I mean, this is not a completely new invention. The Stalin constitution was, on the face of it, one of the most democratic constitutions ever written. It was a beautiful document. It just had nothing to do with the lived reality and the actual politics of the country. So, but I think, yeah, now we're looking at a lot of autocracies that have democracy in their history, right, in their sort of DNA. And I use a lot of the thinking of a Hungarian sociologist named Balint Magyar, who, one of the reasons that I love his work is that he is just such an incredible creator of taxonomies. And so one of the things that he's done is he's sort of outlined the timeline of autocracy and broken it down into autocratic attempt, autocratic breakthrough, and autocratic consolidation. And it's instinctively understandable, right, what those stages are. The one that I think requires a definition is, what is an autocratic breakthrough? Like, how do we know that we're there? And his definition is, an autocratic breakthrough is when you can no longer reverse the autocracy by electoral means. And I think that's a great way to understand the trappings of democracy still remaining while an autocracy exists. Yes, they're there, but there's no power vested in those electoral performances. Hmm.
This is so interesting to me. Because, I mean, in my understanding of Magyar's work, autocracy can function almost as a kind of way station between democracy and full-blown totalitarianism. There is it's as though autocracy and totalitarianism touch, and democracy and autocracy touch.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that there's a meaningful distinction between autocracy and totalitarianism. I think these are separate categories, right? You can have an autocracy that's also a totalitarianism, and you can have an autocracy that's also an authoritarianism. And I think it's authoritarianism that can be a way station to totalitarianism. So, you know, this is, obviously, you love definitions as much as I do.
We are suckers for taxonomies. Right. I mean, you had me a taxonomy.
But the distinction between authoritarianism and totalitarianism that I find most useful is one definition, which is that authoritarianism is essentially when nothing is political. Mm. When citizens are left to live their private lives, and there's a kind of compact between the authoritarian power and the citizens, which is, you know, your life is going to be better. And a lot of the time we see these kinds of authoritarian regimes during times of economic well-being, right? That's certainly what we saw in Russia, was unprecedented economic prosperity that actually fueled Putin's authoritarianism for a long, long time, right? And the compact was, you live your private life and a small group of people or one person will do politics. And that's authoritarianism. Under totalitarianism, everything is political. Nothing is private anymore, right? And that's, you know, that's what Arendt described in The Origins of Totalitarianism, that it's one man of gigantic proportions, space between men, men is the word she used, disappears, right? There's no such thing as a private realm anymore. There's no such thing as a social realm anymore. Everything is the political realm. And so I think that's where Russia is now, right? But it's been an autocracy for a quarter century at this point.
Can I ask the two of you a question? Because this for me kind of gets to the paradox of the current moment. If what's going on in autocracies is the consolidation of a particular form of power, a particular understanding of power, and an understanding of the importance of that power not being meaningfully constrained. Right. So that's the internal understanding of power. That as soon as it's revocable, as soon as it's restrained, something fundamental about the power itself gets lost. Why the need for the performance of legitimacy, of legitimation? Because, I mean, you could almost give it a psychological, you know, the figure, the person, the unitary figure is so insecure in their own role that they need that kind of external reinforcement or legitimation. But I actually think that the psychological evaluation doesn't quite get us. There is something about the need for artificial forms of legitimation that are essential to the exercise of autocratic power itself.
I think there are a couple of things, right? And let's see if we can get to a big answer, because I don't have a big answer, but I have a couple of small observations. One is actually, it goes back to a thought of Hannah Arendt's, which is that, and she has these, you know, beautiful formulations. One of them was, if that power, and by this she means political power, unlike force, it grows when it's divided and diminishes when it's united.
Exactly right.
Right. Mm. And so when power is vested in one person, the political power is weaker. We understand it as weaker. And, you know, and even sort of in the way that it is performed, it becomes weaker because it is one person's statement rather than a process that, you know, that you can follow on TV or on the radio or whatever it is. You follow the process of a bill making its way through Parliament, of any number of people affirming the need for this legislation. An executive order is one person's statement made at a single point in time. And so how do you sort of increase the power of that statement? And I think you do it through spectacle. So I think that's one possible answer. Another is something that you touched on at the beginning, which is the affirmation of the right to hold this power. And a lot of the time it takes the form of, you know, I am doing something that you cannot do. You can observe, you, a member of the public, or even a member of the legislature. With Putin, it's very obvious, right? For a while, he was hanging out with the biggest animals in Siberia, or piloting the biggest fighter plane, or, you know, building the biggest palaces. I am more powerful than you because I have bigger toys, and also I can do this and you can't do this. Therefore, I am powerful. We see this, Trump doing the same thing. And as I think you rightly observed, it's also putting sort of a stake in it. This is mine, right? I destroyed the East Wing of the White House because it is my house. It is not the people's house.
I think we're gathering a lot together under this one label of spectacle, though. So we talk about hanging out with big animals. I think that's a very different thing to a military parade. And I say that for a couple of reasons. One is I think they communicate different things, that being with big animals, building big palaces, extending a wing of a presidential residence, these are all very personal.
Focused on the figure.
Yes, I'm the one with the bear, not you. That's that point. A military parade or something like that, or the pomp and ceremony, I mentioned royal families before, that sort of pomp and ceremony. I think they're offering something slightly different, actually. Military parades are expressions of power. Look at our guns. We are therefore undefeatable. Maybe there's a message to the people. There's no point you rising up. Look at all these things we have. Maybe. But I think actually there's another thing which is a very important element of autocracy, which I mentioned before, which is the idea of getting you to believe that you are part of this grand thing, that you are somehow. Yeah. So I don't think it is merely look at all my weapons, now be scared and be in awe. I think it's also identify with this, because this greatness, okay, I might be the greatest among you, but this greatness is our greatness.
Yeah.
And without that appeal to a greatness, autocracy becomes a very difficult thing to sustain. Otherwise, what are we doing this for? What am I? If we say that people might otherwise yearn for some version of liberty, what would allow you to sacrifice that? What would it be that would encourage you to yield that willingly? Well, the thing that would encourage you to yield that is greatness.
Yeah.
There has to be some appeal to something great. Anyone who, I mentioned the Chinese Communist Party before, anyone who reads the story of the Chinese Communist Party as told by the Chinese Communist Party, and I had the opportunity to do this. I was in Shanghai, I went to the museum. It's beautifully laid out. It tells the story in a very compelling way. A school kid came up to me and told me just how much he loves the Chinese Communist Party and all these sorts of things. He did that unbidden, by the way. That was just, well, I assume unbidden. But I didn't get at all the sense that it was. What's being sold here is the idea of a kind of a liberation and a valorization of the people as such. So when they talk about, and they talk about democracy, they don't talk about it through the, in the way that we do with regular elections and so on and so forth. They talk about it as the expression of the interests of the people as against the interests of the bourgeoisie or some other elite. And I know it creates its own elite in the end, but nonetheless, that elite still exists as a kind of idea. But there has to be this appeal to greatness.
But I think that's the totalitarian trade-off, right? Mm. If the authoritarian compact is your life will be good and you leave us alone to run the country and enrich ourselves, the totalitarian compact is your life is not going to be so good.
Mm. But there's nothing.
But you're going to be compensated by the sense of belonging to something great.
Yeah.
And that was really pronounced in the Soviet Union and in post-Soviet Russia. And part of the reason that the 90s were so painful for so many people was that, not that people started, a lot of people started living measurably worse. I mean, most of the country had lived in abject poverty for decades. But that compensation of, you know, you belong to something great, that was gone. And I think that that's actually something that we don't talk about enough when we talk about the United States, that I fear that that was a lot of what fueled the Trump vote. People, political scientists in the States, you know, can't figure out why somebody would vote for Obama 1 year and then 4 years later vote for Trump. And I think one plausible explanation is that, okay, I've tried to make a deal with the system all my life, right? They keep promising me stuff. They keep promising that my life is going to get better. But actually my life, my sort of subjective well-being has suffered under the Democrats and under the Republicans more or less the same. I'm giving up on that idea. I'm going to throw my lot in with somebody who promises me the other thing, which is that I'll belong to something great.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting example that because, I mean, I think there are a million ways you could explain how an Obama voter becomes a Trump voter, and the notion of just change is one of them, right?
Right.
Maybe Obama didn't change it enough. Let's bring in this guy who will change it more. But I should just mention, if you just joined us, particularly on the radio, you're listening to The Minefield. We're live today on the banks of the Brisbane River as part of the Brisbane Writers Festival in partnership with the University of Queensland Dialogues Across Difference event series. The Trump voter is a fascinating figure in this. The one I'm interested in is not so much the one who voted for Obama and then voted Trump. That actually, to me, in a weird way, makes perfect sense. Mm. The one that perhaps gets more to this phenomenon we're identifying is the one who votes for Trump, sees Trump embark on a series of policies that manifestly make their lives worse, and then votes for Trump again. And the most specific example I can think of are all the soybean farmers. I don't know if you've seen this used before, but soybean farmers in some crucial states in the presidential election, in the Electoral College, vote for Trump. He then embarks on a trade war with China, first term. Soybeans are at the heart of that. Soybeans are very popular in China. And immediately trade shifts to Brazil. And so you have a collapse in what soybean farmers are able to sell. This hurts them directly, manifestly. Okay, 2020 Trump loses, that's in the midst of the pandemic. In some way, 2020 might be a kind of outlier. I suppose it's for historians to look back on that and figure that out, because we're probably too close to it. But then in 2024, they return. While he's pledging tariffs, while he's pledging a trade war, they saw how that went the first time. They sign up for it again. And here, I think, is where this idea of signing up to something bigger really does matter. I think one of the key mistakes a lot of commentators made in trying to understand Trump's Liberation Day, the fact that he called it Liberation Day was significant. Now, clearly, there's an economic liberation that he's kind of talking about, you know, untangling America from being ensnared by globalization and all the winning that everyone else is doing at America's expense and so on. Okay, so there's that kind of economic argument. But actually, there's a bigger political and identity argument there, which is about sovereignty, which is about self-sufficiency, which is about one's own grandeur. Mm. And so objecting to something like the trade war on economic grounds, it seems to me, missed the point entirely. People were quite happy to lose the economic equation, or lose from the economic equation, at the very least in the short to medium term, because the dividend was a non-economic dividend. The dividend was something that was very much driven by... identity is too thin a term for it, actually.
It is something
else. But it's grandeur.
Do you want to pick us up?
I think it is greatness. And I think that the mistake that we often make when we talk about voters whose motivation doesn't make sense to us is we make assumptions about maybe people don't understand that the tariffs are what's making their lives worse or will make their lives worse, and that sort of thing. And that is wrong. Like, the question we should be asking is, what is more important to people than whatever we assumed was going to drive this vote? And I think what's more important to people is a sense of having their grievances heard and aired. And that grievance is probably, it makes more sense as a grievance against the whole world than it does as a grievance about the price of soybeans, right? Because that's the sense that I think that voter has in the world, right? Of being betrayed, put upon, placed in an unstable, unpredictable situation in which it is deeply uncomfortable to live, right? And so if someone is going to say, okay, your life is going to be economically predictable and bad, but also predictable in the sense that I'm going to build a wall around this country. I'm going to isolate you, make you part of this kingdom that I'm going to be making great again, right? Then that's more important. That goes to being heard and to at least being promised to be more comfortable in the world.
And this, I think, is one of the failures that, on the progressive side of party politics, in democracies generally, and I think America's been an example of this, and Australia, I think, has been an example of this, perhaps until recently, which is perhaps another show. Maybe we did do that show. Is that the progressive bargain has largely been one either of economic well-being, trade liberalisation and so on. That was certainly the story in Australia. Or it's been offering some kind of form of social liberation, but never has it really offered a vision of meaning. I've tried over and over, and I've had lots of conversations with people who would describe themselves as avowedly progressive, and whenever I ask the question, aside from non-harm and non-discrimination, what does progressive politics offer as a vision of what matters in life, what constitutes a good life? Nothing much comes back. Now, there's a whole argument you could have there about the roots of that, whether that's just the natural expression of the endpoint of liberalism, which talks only about harm and freedom, and I guess by extension, non-discrimination. But it does rather vacate a field. If someone wants to come along and say, all right, I'm going to plant a flag for what matters, I'm going to plant a flag for the good life, and if that means I'm going to do that by building walls, or that means I'm going to do that by identifying enemies within, or it means I'm going to identify a very narrow vision of who belongs and so on, well, it's pushing against nothing because there's nothing there to hold it. So then the question becomes to me, if that's possible, if that's the field that's been vacated and that's then the invitation that exists to that kind of politics, then is there anything really to stop it adopting what you might call an autocratic posture? I'm not going to say the United States is an autocracy. I don't think you can say that. Mm-hmm. But I think you can say there are autocratic instincts at play, and there is certainly a desire for spectacle at a level that even the United States has not before offered. Isn't that inevitable? If it is as I've described, and feel free to disagree with that, but if it is as I've described, then isn't that the inevitable endpoint? Because it's offering the thing that no one else is offering, and there is profit to be made, in fact, instincts to be served in just offering more and more of it.
All right. Let me pick up one point of rousing agreement with you both, and then I think a point of relatively important disagreement.
Yeah.
Because we are serving the dialogues across difference. we're talking about greatness, meaning that is non-economic meaning in the sense of something in which we can participate. Greatness is a really attractive option in many respects, isn't it? Because you are saying that you are participating in something that is not just good in itself, but is comparatively good. And comparison is always incredibly attractive, politically and morally. Comparison, knowing that I'm better than somebody else, is incredibly. This is why, you know, America's whole thing has never been we're number two or anything resembling. But there's a sting in the tail, isn't there? The sting in the tail is, on the one hand, how is it that I participate in this particular form of greatness?
Yeah, I'd never use the word participate. I would use the word belong. Because it's not about participating.
I agree with that.
Well, I'm not...
No, because the thing that's attractive...
I'm not sure about that. No, hang on. I'm not sure, because participation does suggest, and I think this is the real sting in the tail, there are some who are in and there are some who are out.
Yeah, but you can be in just by virtue of who you are.
Exactly.
That's the best kind of in.
No.
Because you can't even take it away.
Partly. Hang on. Okay, so if the question is there is a form of participation or belonging in greatness that can have a countervailing effect on, say, economic loss or a certain degree of economic immiseration, the question is then, how is it that that form of belonging is enacted? How is it is performed? How is it, if we think about this in almost civic religious terms, what is the sacrament that is being offered that people can then take
up? So you're saying waving my flag or whatever, that's participation.
So if we're talking in standard civic religion terms, here we mean the usual trappings of pledges of allegiance, of participation in sort of in high national holidays, of certain displays of patriotism and so on. But then someone like Trump comes along and offers an entirely different form. Not alien, but a different form of participation, which is, if you are loyal, if you participate in the spectacle that I'm offering. And it seems to me that one of the things that Trump has repeatedly offered is various opportunities to participate in a certain spectacle. I don't know if you all know, but coming up in June, as part of the celebrations of the United States' 250th anniversary, there is going to be an ultimate fighting competition match being held, freedom fights on the lawn of the White House. I mean, Trump himself was ringside at WrestleMania in 2007. He's all for the spectacle of, let's call it, participatory or vicarious strength.
Yeah, but I really think that the word participation is doing us a disservice here, because nobody's participating except for the actual fighters on the White House lawn. You can't even get very close to the White House lawn, even if you're in Washington, D.C., right?
But it's available
you're
on
an observer.
TV.
Right, that's not participation.
And the participation is viewing.
That's not participation. That's a sense, you know, that look at this great thing. I belong to it by doing nothing, by remaining on the couch where I have been sitting all along.
But then there is a form of feeling and perhaps the sense of vicarious belonging that comes along with it. And this is where the other side of, I think, greatness, the allure of greatness comes in. Greatness relies upon a fundamental distinction between us and them.
Right.
I was back in the United States briefly at the end of 2024. There were two moments in 2024 where I thought, Trump has got this in the bag. There is no chance he doesn't win. One was following the assassination attempt. The instinct to perform defiance. The instinct to call out to fight.
And the photo.
It was political genius of a kind I've never seen before. The other was an ad that was running during football games. I myself hate football. My son loves it. Fathers do what fathers have to do. And the ad was about Kamala Harris's record in providing gender-affirming surgery for inmates and immigrants. And the tagline of the ad, Kamala is for they, them. Trump is for you. Politically, that's genius. Now, what that's offering there is not just a form of an invitation to partake, to find yourself on the right side of the greatness line, but it's also an invitation to find oneself within a community that can rightly claim to be, and then you have the adjectives that go along with it, the same adjectives that we heard in the wake of Charlie Kirk's killing, the ones who are beautiful, the ones who build, the ones who contribute, the ones who add to the nation rather than detracting. I think for me, one of the problems with the entire allure of political greatness is that it invites a form of vertical identification, vertical participation, whereas the invitation of democracy and the proper purview of democratic or representative power is to find forms of meaning in the very work of mutually responsible and mutually responsive political effort. And so I think the desire for meaning, the desire to find some kind of, this is a community worth belonging to, the problem is when it's cast along a vertical axis. When it's then, when there's the invitation to discover it through forms of mutual and mutually accountable participation, that's the much harder work of politics. And that's the very form of politics that it seems to me is being renounced by the autocratic temptation.
Yeah, and that's why I would focus on the word participate and not so much actually on the us and them, which may be counterintuitive. But a democratic community is a community with boundaries. There are always those who are inside the democratic community and those who are outside of it. It's one of the sort of unfortunate truths about it, right? We can't have an absolutely, we haven't figured out a way to have an absolutely universal worldwide democratic community or even dream it up, right? So the us and them is not a problem in itself. It's the trappings of us, right? The trappings of us in a totalitarian, and this is where I think, again, totalitarianism is more useful than autocracy. Because everything is political, it also doesn't require any action. It's not about participating, right? It's just about becoming this one man of part of this one man of gigantic proportions while sitting on the couch, right? That's all the participation that's required of you, but that's also all the participation that is given to you. You don't have the option of participating more.
You are listening to The Mindfield on ABC Radio National. This is the Dialogues Across Difference event series. It's a partnership between ABC Radio National's The Mindfield, which is, of course, this show, the University of Queensland, and the Brisbane Writers Festival. I think I might find myself in a position between both of you. I think Em's discussion of belonging as opposed to participation, I think I'm with that. I'm not entirely sure that totalitarianism is quite the right frame for it. Because when I think of totalitarianism, I think of the machinery of it. I think of, you know, mass police forces such that in every house there is a spy, that you don't even know the person that you've married, the mistrust that that must create between citizens and so on. I think you can have this sense of spectacle and belonging and greatness without being in the realm of what we would properly call totalitarianism. You'd have to say it's totalitarianism-ish, perhaps, or it has some of the trappings of it. But even that feels too heavy for what we're trying to describe. We've spent a lot of time talking about the United States. We're nowhere near a totalitarian state in that case. And it just becomes silly, to try to apply those things. Talk to someone who has lived in a genuine totalitarianism and their stories will just be very different. That's just the nature of it. I know people who lived in, and who had dear friends and family and so on, who lived in Assad's Syria. The way they talk about politics and the way they talk about life is just totally different. So I'm just a bit wary of trying to stretch these things a little further. I'm also a little wary about how we might have narrowed the notion of spectacle to be pageantry, parades, the odd photo opportunity with the leader. I'm interested in the evolving nature of spectacle in policy. That when the current American administration sends out ICE officers onto the streets such that violent exchanges between them and immigrants perhaps, but also citizens, is almost certainly going to happen. There's spectacle in that, isn't there? When the Trump administration decides that it's going to bomb Venezuelan boats carrying drugs that are not even bound for America, but overwhelmingly, on the basis of stats, going to be bound for Europe, when there might be other ways of doing that. That's spectacle. That's the performance of a particular worldview, but it's the performance of a particular state power in the enactment of policy, not for the sake of having a wrestling match or a UFC match on the White House lawn or a military parade or something like that. In other words, there's a moment, it seems to me, and look, any Democratic politician who's any good at what they're doing understands theatre. Every election rally is a form of that.
And Democratic politics should be theatrical,
right?
Because it does invite the public to take part.
And in there is a huge amount of promiscuity. But at some point, and I don't know, maybe I can't define this actually, this might be an interesting thing for us to try to do. At some point that tips over into spectacle, where what is being shown is power. It's things going boom. When the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was named shock and awe, almost nothing distilled that. That distills it better than epic fury, actually. Mm. But there is something about a moment at which it becomes instinctive to enact fury, to make power and maybe even suppression, depending on how you want to define that, visible, such that you don't need to participate in it. This is why I think I'm much more in the camp of belonging. I can just watch it. I can just take it in, and I can just say, that is awesome, in the fullest sense of it.
So I take your point about living in actually existing totalitarianism and totalitarianism light. and, you know, having had the experience actually of both, yeah, there's a big difference.
There's a difference.
But I think it's important to identify the symptoms, right? And, you know, we're not going to know whether this is an attempt at building totalitarianism that is going to fail. And so we're going to sort of laugh at what we thought were totalitarian, the symptoms of totalitarianism once this period is over.
Yes.
Or are we going
You're
to
all panicking it? And you lost your minds and all of that will be the judgment of history. Yes.
Exactly. But I think that you're right to focus on ICE in the streets, because I actually, that to me was a sure sign that what he's trying to get to is totalitarianism, right? Because that's state terror. Because what you're seeing with ICE, especially in the streets of Minneapolis, and I don't want to give them too much credit for knowing what they were going to encounter in Minneapolis. I think they didn't know what the hell they were doing. I don't think that they realized they were going to be up against an extremely well-organized, well-networked, politically aware white city. I don't think they imagined that spectacle. But once they were there, what they were performing was state terror, right? They were not performing punishment or isolation of particular groups. I think they were performing, and by state terror, I mean a condition in which every member of the public comes to have a reasonable fear of violence. That's very different from the way that American spectacle of force, which has a long and disturbing tradition, that spectacle has functioned in the past.
But you know what's interesting about the ICE example is, you would know better than me, you live there, but I didn't get the sense that every American did look at that and see themselves as potentially right on the receiving end of that. I got the sense that a lot of Americans, and to be fair, Trump did backtrack, so maybe he did run into resistance he wasn't expecting. But I got the sense a lot of Americans saw it more as the righteous expression of force against those who either deserve it or are complicit. That is, things haven't really reached the point of understanding the possibility of state power as a pervasive threat. Only as a threat, a partisan threat, if you like. A threat, you know, ICE goes to blue states. So these sorts of things.
Right. No, that's a fair point. And again, I think this is something we're not going to know for a while. It's clear that a greater number of Americans recoiled at this spectacle than Trump expected. Mm. And that's probably the biggest reason that he has stepped away a little bit. But
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit, yeah. And I think there was a real escalation, right? And which is why I think it reads as an attempt at state terror, right? First you have a white woman, but she's a lesbian, right? And then you have a white guy who has a gun And like, who do MAGA voters identify with more than a white guy with a gun who worked at a Veterans Affairs hospital, right?
And who was blamed for carrying the gun, which crossed all sorts of fault lines in the American political landscape, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Part of the message of ICE, and I just want to end on a slightly different note.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the message of ICE is, this is our world, you're just living in it. In many respects, that is part of the message of autocratic or more broadly totalitarian governments. This is our world, and the way that you participate, the way that you live in it, is through acquiescence, yeah. Through quiescence. The existence of, say, independent political bodies or independent electoral authorities. I mean, there is nothing in American life that is not partisan in some profound way. The existence, for instance, of an Australian Electoral Commission is to hold out those areas in the life of a nation that says there is still something here in which, by means of which, we participate in some kind of shared political project. It seems to me that even in a place that is so heavily partisan like the United States, the possibility of deliberation, of mutual accountability, of mutual responsiveness, of restraint. These are all the things, and Hannah Arendt observed this very, very clearly. These are the forms of restraint that exist within a political order that still hold out the possibility and the promise, not so much of the existence of a common world, the conditions of our common life, but the possibility that through political cooperation we can achieve that common life together. So it does seem to me that there is a reason why autocratic governments are so extraordinarily contemptuous of practices of deliberation itself. You don't want to see or seem to be seen to be constraining what it is that one wants to do. I just wonder if you'd like to conclude our conversation by talking about deliberation.
Sure, and I think you've brought it full circle beautifully, because here again I will go back to Balint Magyar, who calls deliberation the process of understanding our obligations to one another.
That's right.
And that's really what the spectacle is about, right? It's about demonstrating, I have no obligations to you. I may choose to pull you closer, I may choose to give you money, I may choose to give you power, I may choose to do none of that, but none of that, none of what I do in relationship to you, because I reject deliberation as such, none of it is a function of my obligation to you, right? And that's the assertion of autocratic power.
All right. You said that was the note on which to end.
Oh, yeah.
It is the note on which we will end. Em, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wonderful to have you here. And thank you so much to everybody who's been here. And that's where we will leave that discussion that we had in Brisbane. A huge thanks to our guest, Em Gessen, Russian-American journalist, author of Surviving Autocracy and The Future is History. We recorded that episode in front of a live audience in Brisbane as part of the University of Queensland's Dialogues Across Difference talk series, also in partnership with the Brisbane Writers Festival. Had a great time. Maybe we'll do it again. That is it for The Minefield for this week. You can catch us again next week on ABC Radio National in perhaps a more normal format, or you can listen to us anytime you like on ABC Listen. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.